Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Dr. Ruth Shapiro, social entrepreneur in residence at the Commonwealth Club and your moderator for today's program. This evening's program is being held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Asia-Pacific Affairs member-led forum, and it is also being held in association with our collegial organizations, Japan Society of Northern California, Thai Silicon Valley, and the Keizai Society. Welcome to the members of all these organizations. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, John Roos, U.S. Ambassador to Japan. Reading Ambassador Roos' CV, one cannot help but admire the determination, leadership, and intellect that has characterized all his professional and academic endeavors since graduating from Lowell High School in the early 70s. He went on to achieve academic excellence at Stanford both as an undergraduate and in law school, where he served on the Stanford Law Review. He went on to Wilson Sonsini Goodrich and Rosati, where he became the chief executive officer and helped to bring about the extraordinary growth of Silicon Valley. Throughout all these achievements, Ambassador Roos remained politically active in local government and in several important political campaigns, including most recently President Barack Obama's. It must be only as the ambassador to such an important country as Japan that he would actually leave the Bay Area, because you can sense throughout his career he has been firmly committed to our neck of the woods. I imagine he did so knowing that after his stint as ambassador, he could, in fact, come back. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Ambassador John Roos.
I don't think I need the gavel.
Yeah.
Well,
I feel safer when you don't have it.
Thank you very much, Ruth, for that introduction. I think with those academic credentials you laid out, had a strong start. Wendy Wonderman, who put together this program, said, now when you walk up to the podium, make sure you sit behind the sign saying John Roos rather than Ruth Shapiro. So I appreciate that introduction. It's particularly nice for me to be here at the Commonwealth Club, where for so many years I've had the opportunity to see some pretty wonderful and interesting events here, and I hope I can live up to the Commonwealth's reputation. It's really hard to believe that I've been in Japan now for a little over a year. This year has been exciting for me and for my family, who is here tonight. And it's an understatement to say that it's been full of challenges, many of which I look forward to discussing with you over the next hour. But I also have to admit, it's been very nice to be home. In addition to getting my son started at Stanford yesterday as a freshman, I look forward to catching a Giants game tomorrow night against the Dodgers. And it's great to see that the Giants are in the division race. In Japan, we have the Tokyo Giants, who the Japanese often compare to the New York Yankees. And as a result, while I enjoy going to their games, I got to tell you, it's pretty tough to root for them. People ask me, what was the toughest diplomatic challenge I've had since arriving in Japan? It's the fact that I had to hand a World Series trophy at a ceremony to the New York Yankees. That being said, that baseball is just one of the many areas where our two countries really do connect. Japan, as you know, is an unbelievable story of success over the last 65 years. However, while you absolutely would not know it walking through the streets of Tokyo, Japan obviously is going through a difficult period both economically and politically. Economically, after years of really astronomical growth and development, it has been challenged by not only one lost decade, but now people are talking about a second lost decade. This has been reflected in an average growth rate well under 2% a year. On top of all this, deflation and a declining and aging population add to Japan's current challenges. Not unrelated to the economic situation, the political dynamic in Japan has been turbulent in recent years as well. Just since I arrived in Japan as the ambassador last August, Japan has had three prime ministers. 2 weeks after I arrived in Tokyo, Japan changed governing parties for virtually the first time in 50 years. A dissatisfied electorate ousted the Liberal Democratic Party in favor of the Democratic Party of Japan, or the DPJ. But just 8 months later, the DPJ's first prime minister, Hatoyama, also a Stanford graduate, he got a PhD in engineering at Stanford, Prime Minister Hatoyama resigned as his poll numbers dropped from the high 60s to below 20%, and his coalition government fell apart. And then, just this last July, a couple of months ago, the DPJ suffered another significant setback in their upper house elections, resulting in a divided Diet and an intra-party struggle for control, which ended just yesterday, right before I got on the plane to come here, with the re-election of Prime Minister Kan as the leader of the DPJ, and therefore he will remain as prime minister. But despite these many challenges, Japan is as important to us, the United States, as it's ever been. One way I look at our partnership with Japan is that it's comprised of three essential pillars: a security pillar, an economic pillar, and a global partnership pillar. Underpinning our security, economic, and global work together are what I have come to call the foundational elements of our relationship that emerge from interactions between peoples. These are educational exchanges, cultural exchanges, scientific exchanges, and business relationships. I will elaborate a little bit on this later, but let me first describe what I mean in terms of the three pillars of our relationship. In the area of security, as President Obama has emphasized, our alliance with Japan remains the cornerstone of the United States' strategic policy in Asia, which constitutes over 40% of the global economy. And some say the Asian economy is even more than 40% at this stage. This year, we are celebrating the 50th anniversary of our security alliance with Japan, which has provided a half century of stability in East Asia. This stability has allowed not only Japan, but the entire region to reach unprecedented levels of prosperity, which in turn has been critical to our own prosperity. Looking ahead, while the challenges in East Asia are vastly different than they were 50 years ago and during the Cold War, they are no less serious or significant today. North Korea continues to present one of the region's most enduring challenges. The North Koreans are the most militarized state in the world. They're developing ballistic missile capabilities, engaging in nuclear tests, and proliferating weapons technology to earn revenues from dangerous regimes around the world. And of course, we all know of its recent unprovoked torpedo attack on the South Korean ship, the Chonan, which killed 47 South Koreans. The possibility of regime collapse, particularly in the context of leadership succession by Kim Jong-il's 28-year-old son, is a growing concern. A North Korea that falls into internal disarray would pose monumental security challenges in the region. Our special envoy, Stephen Bosworth, is now, as we speak, traveling in the region to assess the way forward in dealing with North Korea on the issues in what are called the six-party talks, particularly on the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. They have Special Envoy Bosworth and his team had very good talks in Tokyo and Seoul in the last couple of days, and have firmly agreed that we and our partners and allies must work closely over the next several weeks and months as we look for the right moment to start the multilateral efforts to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. Now, let me talk about China for a minute. China is perhaps the best example of the complexities confronting us in East Asia today. There is no doubt that the three biggest economies in the world, the United States, China, and Japan, are increasingly interdependent. Japan and China are important holders of U.S. debt, as you know. China cannot succeed without U.S. and Japanese technology. And Japan and China depend on U.S. markets just as we depend on China's and Japan's markets. The interplay among our three countries has emerged as a driver in the global economy. When I was at Wilson Sonsini, I helped open our first overseas office in Shanghai because of the enormous opportunities that its growing economies present for us. President Obama has emphasized that the U.S. seeks a positive, cooperative, and comprehensive relationship with China, and the world is counting on Beijing to work with the United States, Japan, and the international community to address a number of key global challenges. Yet, even as the United States and Japan work with China as a partner in so many areas, just as there are issues in the economic arena, the issues Google has faced, for example, we have questions about the potential implications about China's accelerating and non-transparent military modernization, which increases the potential for misunderstanding and miscalculation. There are also current concerns in the region about China's recent naval exercises in the South China Sea and East China Sea, where billions of dollars of commerce pass each year. So while I want to be very careful not to overstate these concerns, I do want to state clearly that our alliance with Japan plays a very important role in ensuring that the dramatic changes in the security environment in East Asia do not negatively affect the region's future peace and prosperity. Our alliance is the critical stabilizing force in this area of the world. We hear this over and over and over again from our allies in the region, from South Korea to Southeast Asia to Australia. Let me turn now to our economic relationship. I talked about Japan's economic worries a few minutes ago, but you don't need me to tell you that Japan remains a vital economic partner for the United States. I could rattle through a long list of figures and statistics here, but let me just say that from food and agriculture to healthcare and telecom to manufacturing and finance, Japan is among our primary partners in the world. Manufacturers in a broad range of industries in both countries, from the makers of airplanes and automobiles to the high-tech sector, do a booming business across the Pacific. Close to home here, for example, it's probably not surprising for you to hear that Apple stores across Tokyo are packed, as everyone now seems to be walking around with an iPhone, and I'm sure we'll soon be seeing the iPads as well. As an aside, you may not know that Twitter is also huge in Japan, so much so that 25% of all tweets in the world are Japanese. On that note, I'm about to launch when I return from the United States, my own Twitter feed. And the desire is to reach out to young people. And, you know, while I'll tell you, I have no idea how many followers I'll have. I've heard estimates anywhere from 1,000 to 100,000. I have no doubt that my mother will appreciate knowing where I am at all times. Let me just touch on a few points on the third pillar, our global work together. Whether it's in the areas such as energy security, nuclear disarmament, or humanitarian assistance, among others, our two nations are converting our strategic and economic relationship into a truly invaluable global partnership. When President Obama visited Tokyo last November, he and former Prime Minister Hatoyama agreed that the United States and Japan, as the world's two leading investors in energy research and development, should expand our cooperation to develop solutions to the twin challenges of energy security and climate change. Since then, we have been deepening our cooperation on energy technology in several areas, low carbon technology, energy efficiency, and smart grid, to name a few. The potential for significant progress in this area is huge. And I can tell you, after having traveled throughout Japan last year and seen some of the cutting-edge technologies that are being developed, the opportunities in both the public and private sector for further collaboration are enormous. Japan holds the largest number of unused patents in the world. Its technologies are revolutionary. Here we have a real opportunity to bring together our business expertise and culture of entrepreneurship, especially here in Northern California, with some of Japan's technical capabilities. It's not without reason that a few months ago, Toyota entered into a partnership with Tesla Motors, a Silicon Valley company, to develop the next generation of electric cars. Another global challenge in which the United States and Japan are working together is the nuclear proliferation issue. President Obama's Prague speech last year captured the imagination of the world and countless Japanese when he spoke of the United States' commitment to a world without nuclear weapons. For obvious reasons, the nuclear issue touches a nerve from Tokyo to Japan's tiniest villages. Last month, I became the first U.S. official ever to attend the August 6th anniversary commemoration in Hiroshima. I attended the ceremony not only to pay respect to all of the victims of World War II, but to help advance President Obama's non-nuclear agenda. While this made some stories here in the United States, it was huge in Japan. Since then, everywhere I have gone, Japanese citizens have come up to me and thanked me, and letters have continued to pour into my office. The issue continues to ripple through the op-ed pages in Japan. The nuclear issue is important to the Japanese, and their work with us in this area is critical. Not only have we relied, and we will continue to rely, on the leadership of Japan in our joint work in preventing North Korea from becoming a nuclear power, but other countries as well, in particular Iran at the current moment, where both our countries are imposing significant sanctions which go beyond the recently adopted UN sanctions. In the area of humanitarian assistance, in the last year alone, we have worked with Japan in providing assistance in Haiti, in advancing our agenda in Afghanistan, where Japan is the second biggest contributor of civilian assistance with a $5 billion financial commitment, and most recently, in addressing the catastrophic floods in Pakistan, where Japan is not only providing financial assistance, but critically needed heavy helicopter lift as well. So as I just laid out, whether it be in our mutual security, the strength of our economies, or global issues, Japan is essential to us as a nation. People ask me all the time, am I concerned about some of the issues that we are currently working through? My answer is no. I see these conversations as part of the dialogue required in any strong relationship. Japan and the United States share the same democratic values. The lines of communication are open, and the conversation is wide-ranging and rich. We are urging, for example, the Japanese to open their markets to American beef, which, by the way, our two governments discussed right here in San Francisco earlier today. And we're asking Japan to ensure a level playing field in its privatization of Japan Post, which you may not know is the world's largest financial institution. We are working hard to encourage the Japanese to sign the Hague Convention on International Parental Child Abduction. More than 100 American children, including 30 right here in California, have been abducted by one parent to Japan, usually in connection with a divorce. These left-behind parents deserve access to their children, and their children deserve to see their parents, and we are working hard through diplomatic channels to make that happen. We are, of course, in continued dialogue with Japan on security issues and realigning our military bases, including the Futenma Marine Air Force Base in Okinawa, which I'm sure for those of you who have been following Japan have read about in the news. We worked out a deal in May of this year, which we are proceeding to implement. So no, I am not overly concerned about the nature of our issues with Japan. What I do worry about, however, is our need to strengthen what I referred to earlier as the foundational element which I believe will determine the future strength of our relationship. Because of time, let me just give you one example: education. The number of Japanese students choosing to study in the United States has been steadily decreasing in recent years, and the number of American students studying in Japan is woefully low. It is a dangerous trend that we must work to counter. As many of you, I'm sure, have found out through your own lives and through those of your children, the impressions formed through a study abroad experience inform a person's perspective throughout his or her entire life. Many of Japan's CEOs and political leaders who are most committed to the United States relationship studied in this country, many of them right here at Stanford, some of them, a few, across the bay at Cal. I remember when I was at Lowell, one of the biggest and most memorable events was when our orchestra traveled to Japan to play. We need to connect Japan's young people who have grown up during these two decades of economic decline. We need to inspire them to come to our country to study, to work, to connect to our young people, and we need our students to equally go to Japan. Like our focus on education, though, we can never take our eye off the ball on the importance of the cultural, scientific, and business connections that I believe will have the greatest impact on the future relationship of our two countries. Let me end with this final thought. Despite our challenges, I have been consistently amazed by the real connections between our two countries. Our people continue to share a fascination with each other that was born in the post-war years, surged in the 1980s, and continues today. I was just with Governor Schwarzenegger in Tokyo a few days ago. Actually, technically, it was yesterday. I was both with Schwarzenegger in Tokyo and my son at Stanford, all on Tuesday. But let me tell you, the Japanese love them. And by connection, they love California. From the surf shops to the street fashions to the Hollywood film premieres, The love affair with America is still real. And the feeling, by the way, is mutual. In the last year, my own family has fallen prey to the American fascination with Japan. We have thoroughly enjoyed the country from Hokkaido down to Okinawa. I've made it a point to travel widely throughout Japan, getting to know the culture outside of Tokyo. One of my more memorable stops was in Obama City, not named after the president. But in Obama City, people line the streets when Susie and I arrived, waving American flags and pictures of President Obama. It's an unbelievable honor for me and my family to be representing our country at what many people continue to tell me is a historic juncture of the relationship between our two countries. And as a San Franciscan, I'm proud to come back home to talk to you about my first year in Japan. Nothing truly could be more exciting or gratifying than to be contributing, if only in a very small way, to the challenges and opportunities we face together in the 21st century. Thank you.
Our thanks to United States Ambassador to Japan, John Roos, for his comments this evening. It's now time for our audience question and answer period. Ambassador Roos, please stay up there, and I will very comfortably sit here and answer. So we have quite a few questions, and not surprisingly, they break down into political, economic, and social issues.
That's good to hear, given my speech.
Yeah. Well, yes. And the reality of the day.
All right.
Your speech was right on. Okay, let's start with the political. We'll end with the cultural, okay? Okinawa and Futenma, there is an agreement in place, but it's a highly politicized issue in Japan. What do you think is going to happen there, and what are the issues that could sway the outcome one way or another?
Thank you for asking me a Futenma question first.
Get it out of the way.
Let me give you a little background on the issue. First of all, I remain convinced that our two countries will work through that issue together. For those of you who are not aware of the issue, the security treaty between the United States and Japan, which, as I mentioned, we're celebrating our 50th anniversary, provided for mutual commitments. The commitment of the United States was to contribute to the defense of Japan. The commitment of Japan was to provide the military bases to the United States so that we could accomplish a couple of different things. Number one is help contribute to the security of Japan. And number two was to use the bases to maintain stability in that part of the world. As I said, the treaty has been a major success. 75% of our military bases are located in Okinawa. For years, there has been pressure to reduce the footprint of our bases in Okinawa. A triggering event in 1995 on this Futenma Marine Air Station that is the big controversy that everyone has been focused on is the following. There was a rape of a young girl in Japan by a Marine. At that point in time, the United States made the commitment to close the Futenma Air Base, but we had to find a replacement for it. During the next several years, our two countries entered into an incredibly complex negotiation that led to an agreement with 19 different parts and an unbelievable number of subparts of those 19 parts. One part of that agreement, which was arrived at in 2006 after a decade of discussions, was to close Futenma and to relocate it to a less populated base north in Okinawa. But it involved some landfill in a bay in a place called Henoko. Other parts to the agreement which are significant is the return, not only the closing of Futenma, but the return to Japan of a significant amount of land, of base land in Okinawa, 65% of the land technically south of this major Kadena Air Force Base in Okinawa. So you get the idea, a complex negotiation over a dozen years that leads to this compromise agreement that was both sides liked certain parts, both sides didn't like different parts. What happened was that when the Hatoyama administration came in, less than a year ago, they wanted to take a look at the Futenma piece of the negotiation that was moving to the northern base. And our two governments got into a significant discussion about that agreement. The final agreement, which I shouldn't use the word final because these discussions continue, but the May agreement that we entered into provided that the base would be, Futenma would be closed. The base would be moved up north to this Henoko area, this less populated area, and that we would work together, the United States government and the Japanese government, to further reduce the impact of our bases in Okinawa. We have begun that process, and it has been a difficult process. And we have only taken a first step, and that there are many, many more steps ahead of us and many difficult issues we face. But the bottom line is I have always believed that because this alliance is so critical to our two countries, whether it's the Futenma base or some other issue that we are likely to confront, as long as we continue to have the positive dialogue that we have, we will work through these issues.
Thank you very much. We have all watched the revolving door of prime ministers in Japan, and it's somewhat common knowledge that the government has had a hard time getting its act together, especially among its elected officials. A number of business people say it doesn't matter. We go ahead and arrange business-to-business relationships, and the role of government is becoming increasingly irrelevant. Now, you, of course, represent the United States in a bilateral government relationship, but how would you comment on the notion that business can just go ahead and leave government to its own dealings?
I would disagree with that concept.
And
I will tell you that I continually have meetings with businessmen throughout Japan, mm-hmm. and businessmen and women in the United States. And I will tell you this, there is no one that I have met that espouses that theory that the government does not matter and that the policies that they implement do not matter. Just the opposite. I think there is a strong belief among the Japanese businessmen and the American businessmen that policies are important and can affect a whole variety of business-related issues between our two countries. So I would fundamentally disagree with the premise.
Okay. That's good. Let's talk a little bit about North Korea. There's a number of questions essentially stating why has North Korea not been dealt with more effectively? It's relatively small. It's relatively isolated. Very large powers are involved. What is your sense about where that dialogue is going to go and what can really move it forward?
Well, I think it's a very complex issue. Obviously, as I hear the day-to-day permutations of what's going on with the North Korea situation. I more and more appreciate the complexities of it. I think that, as I mentioned, Secretary Bosworth, who is the U.S. representative to the six-party talks that are meant to deal with the North Korea situation, is being patient but firm. We have the good news is that the parties up to the talks, obviously other than North Korea, are coordinating closely, are in constant dialogue. We have sanctions on North Korea. We're working hard to move the six-party talks forward, but it's critically important that North Korea make moves towards denuclearization. And I think all of us are in agreement that we shouldn't be talking just for talking's sake. We many times have gone down that path and to no avail. And I think that the Obama administration, which, as you know, is very open to dialogue around the world, is cautiously approaching this, trying to get North Korea to the table, but in the right way. And so, you know, it's my personal belief, and my belief as the ambassador, that while it's very important that North Korea not become a nuclear power, we also should not rush into any action that we could look back on and question later on. Can I comment?
Sure. I didn't know you were finished talking.
No, I want on the prior question where you talked about the instability of the Japanese government. You phrased it a little differently.
Among politically elected Japanese.
Among the politically elected.
The bureaucracy is quite stable.
I think that we need to be patient. You know, Japan has just gone through a massive change. After 50 years of having one-party rule, the DPJ took over. The reality is that prior to that time, they were a minority party that didn't have a lot of information, briefings, et cetera, on the issues that they were about to confront. It's been a year. I know everyone looks at the situation and says it's unacceptable, but I do believe that, you know, it will take some time to work through the governance issues, and this is not supporting one party or another. Mm-hmm. But I think when we're talking about the United States approach and President Obama's approach to these issues is to be patient as the new administration and the new ruling party works through its issues.
Okay, thank you. There are quite a few questions about the triangle between China, Japan, and the United States. Let me start by asking, a number of Asian countries, and this was voiced quite emphatically by Lee Kuan Yew last year, have asked the United States to engage more in Asia as a way to hedge, if you will, against China's growth. Do you think the United States needs to engage more, and if so, how?
Well, I think the United States is engaging more. I think that what President Obama came to Tokyo last November and gave the speech, he traveled throughout Asia, he was in China, he was in South Korea, and the major address he gave was in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And the point of that address was that the United States was back, fully engaged in Asia, recognizes the importance of the entire region to the future of the United States. So I think we are significantly engaged. It's clear that we are significantly engaged in many levels mm-hmm. with China, including the strategic and economic dialogue, but getting back to both the public and private sector, mm-hmm. I don't think, from my perspective, there is an issue with a lack of engagement with China. Mm-hmm. And with the rest of the region, we are heavily engaged because I believe that the Obama administration truly recognizes the importance of the region. In fact, he made a point of saying that, you know, he was the first Asia-Pacific president, and he was going to operate his presidency as the first Asia-Pacific president.
Okay. I was listening to what you were saying and lost my train of thought. On China, I was in Japan earlier this summer, and there is great degree of, I suppose, somberness among Japanese business leaders regarding China's growth. You talked a lot about the fundamental relationship between the United States and Japan, and so did many of the Japanese that I spoke to, as something that was critical. The example you gave of increasing Japanese students here and our students studying in Japan is a good one. What else can we do to re-strengthen, I suppose, the U.S.-Japan relationship?
I will answer that, but let me make one comment on China first. I don't think, as some people say, it's a zero-sum game.
Right.
Strengthening the relationship with China is at the expense of Japan or any other country or vice versa. In fact, from our perspective, it's important that we strengthen our relations with both countries. Obviously, we have a very special relationship and alliance with Japan, but that doesn't mean that Japan should not strengthen its relationship with China. Or that we shouldn't. What was the actual question?
How are we going to do that?
Oh, how are we going to do it other than the educational
right.
areas? With Japan.
Right.
Well, I think that there are a number of areas. I think as one thing that I'm intimately familiar with is the business community and the whole coming from the Silicon Valley. I think there is a tremendous opportunity to connect the Silicon Valley to Japan and to have much more interaction. As I travel around Japan, everyone asks me, what's the formula of the Silicon Valley? How can we learn from you? And the way to learn and the way to help both the Japanese economy and the United States economy is to create more and more opportunities for those communities to get together. Mm-hmm. In the scientific area, I talked about education, scientific exchanges, cultural exchanges, and business. In the scientific area, we are doing but can be doing a lot more in outer space. The International Space Station, a couple of days ago, I met with Japanese astronauts, Russian astronauts, and United States astronauts who were up in the International Space Station. It's amazing the scientific work mm-hmm. that they are doing together and how the connection between the countries that are participating in that project grow. Those are the types of things that we need to emphasize. In the cultural area, not to plug my wife, who's sitting in the front row here, but she put together, for the first time in embassy history, an exhibit at our residence that was Japanese artists have spent a significant amount of time either living or working in the United States. That received unbelievable exposure, acclaim in Japan. It connected with people. The more of those things we can do to strengthen the cultural interactions. Growing up here in San Francisco, you know, the Japantown was a huge part of people's lives, the Japanese tea gardens. We need to strengthen those, not let them get weaker. I just read recently that the Japan newspaper here in San Francisco, which was the oldest Japan paper in the United States, closed its doors. Now, obviously, newspapers are undergoing tremendous pressure across the board, but each one of these types of things that happen weaken the relationship. And so the more of these cultural art mm-hmm. exchanges, music, there's a series of film premieres coming from the United States over to Japan that the Japanese are very into. The whole cool Japan is now spreading here to the United States. Those are very important connections. And sometimes we spend more time talking about, and I don't mean to say that's not critically important, but sometimes we spend more time talking about, military base issues than we do about some of these critical foundational elements that will determine the relationship.
No, I think it's very true. And, in Japanese, there's the term ningen kankei, which is human relations, and it's very important to help to connect that.
One other thing, if I could add, is that I believe when you talk about Japan, the United States, and China, in the whole area of renewable energy, mm-hmm. that our three countries can work together. And there's amazing things going on in all three of the countries. And if we could have a collaborative effort once again, that can bring our countries closer together, mm-hmm. which I think is important.
Can you imagine being involved in such an initiative?
I can not only imagine being involved in an initiative, I'm pushing such an initiative, so hopefully I will be involved.
Very good. All right. Then we hope that you'll come back to the Commonwealth Club and report on your progress once you've made that.
I would love to.
Okay, good. Let's talk about the Silicon Valley model. What are the characteristics? Of course, you understand what has made Silicon Valley work and succeed very well. What are the characteristics that translate well into Japan, and which ones do not?
Well, I speak all over Japan about the Silicon Valley because of that's the way I was introduced to Japan. And so a lot of people have sought me out. And I talk about the tangible and intangible qualities that make the Silicon Valley, and I would need another hour to go into that. But Japan has amazing technology, a lot of technology that is in corporations that, if it's not part of their strategic plan, doesn't go anywhere.
Right.
In the Silicon Valley, that ends up getting spun out by either individuals or corporations into additional opportunities that build new companies. So I believe that there are ways to capitalize on some of the strengths of Japan. They have amazing technology. The other day, I rode with Governor Schwarzenegger, the Shinkansen, the bullet train that Japan has, that I know California is looking at. But a week ago, I rode what's called Maglev technology in their next generation of bullet train. Amazing technology mm-hmm. that, by the way, I was told, and I experienced it, I was told that you could get to San Francisco to L.A. in less than 2 hours, an hour and a half. That's not the technology that we're looking at here in California because it's got a ways to go, but even the Shinkansen would be a significant benefit to the infrastructure here. But getting back to the Valley, the biggest difference between Japan and the United States is we have a risk-taking culture here where if you start a company and you fail, it's not viewed as failure. It's viewed as a learning experience. In Japan, it's viewed as failure. Mm-hmm. And people are more conservative and more risk-averse. And while I think that is changing, and what we're doing at the embassy is looking for opportunities to show role models in Japan to the Japanese people. I think that's probably the biggest intangible hurdle. There are others. The Silicon Valley was built on diversity. Mm-hmm. People from all different countries coming in to build the valley. That's not the situation in Japan. And then there's government policies that, tax policies and those types of things. But it's the intangibles that are actually the more difficult challenges. That being said, I believe that Japan will get there. And as I point out all over the country, post-World War II, Japan was the most entrepreneurial country in the world and built some unbelievable companies. And I believe that that's in Japan's future.
The Japanese ambassador to the United States spoke here at the Commonwealth Club several months ago. And when asked that question about entrepreneurship, he essentially said, it only happens within large companies. And, you know, the role of the individual entrepreneur really doesn't exist within Japan. Do you see that changing, or do you see, because these large companies, of course, are quite innovative when you think about Toyota, et cetera. Right. But does the individual have to play a role as they have in Silicon Valley?
Well, I think it's happening both ways. Uh-huh. Obviously, you know, the big corporate model is incredibly important in Japan. But more and more, it's slow, but more and more we are seeing examples of success stories. And interestingly, a couple of the more of the bigger success stories are now requiring English to be the main language in their companies. And I find that to be a very interesting phenomenon taking place, that through the global, these companies need to compete globally, that more and more there seems to be an emphasis on English. But I wouldn't disagree with the ambassador. Mm-hmm. I would add to his comment that there.
Of course. Okay. These are strange times we're living in, because while there were questions about Silicon Valley as a model, there are actually more questions about Japan as a model to us in terms of how can we live it and be happy in a really depressed economy. And what lessons can Japan provide us in terms of dealing with potentially our soon-to-be lost decade?
No comment. I don't think there's some magic formula. I think that every person has to determine for themselves how to be happy. I think if you go across Japan, it really is, I will tell you, they have had a couple of lost decades. Japan has huge challenges, but it's a wonderful, wonderful country. It has amazing traditions. And I guess if I had to answer
I
would say that, and this is one thing that Susie and I have been struck by, Japan really appreciates the little things, beauty. They can make, you know, in when we get handed presents, all of which, for the record, we ethically report to the State Department. But when we get handed presents, they are just beautifully wrapped because the Japanese take pride in the little details, flower arrangements. I mean, if I had to point to one thing, which is difficult to do.
They literally do smell the roses.
They do smell the roses.
Okay. Let me just, before I ask the next question, let me just put a reminder in for our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our guest today is John Roos, U.S. Ambassador to Japan, who is sharing his thoughts on the changing political landscape and Japan's relationship with the United States. Okay, Ambassador, let's go on to the social/cultural questions. I think we must have a number of Japanese students in the room because there's concern about what you cited earlier, the fairly dramatic decrease of Japanese students here. And the questions are, why do you believe it's happening, and what can we do to turn it around in both directions?
Well, that's an interesting question because one of the things that I've done is when I travel throughout Japan, I make it a point to go to schools, universities, and other schools in order to talk to students and hear what's on their mind. And they point to a whole series of factors, in no particular order. Financial, situation. It's just a lot less expensive to stay in Japan and go to school there. Number two, that in order to get a good job out of college, their system does not appreciate or look to as a big positive, and obviously there are exceptions, study abroad. It's a much easier path to that first job staying within the university system, the college system in Japan.
But that would have been true before as well.
Are you saying recent trends? Well, let me just keep going.
Okay, keep going.
If we talk about the 14% or whatever it was last year and the 40% over a series of years, there's a declining population. There's some demographics. There is the fact that because of that declining population, it is easier to get into college at the universities there. There is an, interestingly, I think this would surprise people, at least it did surprise me, there is a perception that it's not safe to go to school in the United States. And I hear this, you know, when you see the media exposure of, you know, things that happen on our campuses, that feeds into you know, the internet and the news in Japan. There's also an interesting perspective that Japanese students are less globalized than before, that they can get, and I do hear this, and this is also interesting, they can get what they need over the internet. Now, that's not generally true, but you do hear that from different people. I think, listen, as far as reversing this, I'm personally working on a series of initiatives, including talking to universities and making financial aid more open to overseas students, talking to universities here and aggressively recruiting, having scholarships that are more available to students there, speaking, getting students to speak to other students to say that it's incredibly important for them to do it. A lot of students, every student you talk to that has the experience says it's one of the best experiences they've ever had. I talk to CEOs all the time, and whenever I talk to CEOs in Japan, I say, you know, they talk about the lack of students doing it. I say, well, it's pretty easy for you guys to change this by saying, you know, we're going to give an advantage to people that spend time overseas in our hiring decisions. So there's a whole series of things. It's not easy, but there's a whole series. You can't change. We in the United States cannot change the demographics. Japan's working on it. But there's a whole series of things that we can do together to reverse the trend.
Ambassador Roos, you have clearly impressed some of the people in this audience with your skill, because a number of them want to know how you're going to change the gender imbalance in terms of workplace issues in Japan, and how you can promote equal opportunity for women in the workplace. So please let us know how you're going to do that.
Well, you want my answer?
Yes, of course.
it's a huge issue. It is getting better, but again, it's an issue that every opportunity I get, I talk about with the business leaders and describe, you know, interestingly, we all know we have major issues in this country. But somehow when I'm describing what we do in this country, we look like heroes compared to the issues that Japan's facing. Susie, my wife, who is an entrepreneur, started her own law firm, practicing attorney, has been asked and is going to be speaking all over Japan about how she balanced her two responsibilities. I also have responsibilities as a father, by the way, and I balance the two.
And you talk about that publicly?
But in any event, I think that there's a lot we can do. Interestingly, we hear all the time and see, I think it's starting to show up in the statistics, that women, female students, are being much more aggressive in studying, in wanting to study abroad. I don't know if it shows up in the statistics yet, but, you know, when I go to groups or plan to come to the United States, I would say a lot of them are 75% women and 25% male. So that to me is a nice sign that of the recognition that they want to take charge and really change things. And I believe it will be slow, but it will change.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, it would mark a very interesting evolution in Japanese history, and probably economic development. Okay, the last question is a really hard one. You ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. The question is, how has your experience as a lawyer and the CEO of a very significant law firm helped you or harmed you as an ambassador in Japan?
I think it's, and I'm really not just saying this because I didn't know going in, I think it's been an unbelievable asset. I think, first of all, being a lawyer, you know how to work with different interests, bring them together, get a deal done, and compromise and find what's important to both sides. And I have found that in almost every issue I deal with. I was in the middle of these Futenma negotiations. That was a very complex negotiation and will continue to be. But I believe my skills as a lawyer really helped. As far as a CEO of a law firm, a couple of my partners are here in the audience. So I will say this. Managing a law firm is bringing together a lot of different interests, a lot of very strong, talented people to get them on the same page, much as doing a transaction is. And that's what my current role in Japan is. So I'll let ultimately the president is the ultimate decider of the job I do, but I think the people in Japan and in the United States will further be the judges of whether what I bring to the table and the background I've had actually adds value. I hope that will be the case.
Well, it's been the case certainly for us for the last hour. I want to thank you very much for coming and speaking at the Commonwealth Club. We also thank our audience here and on the radio, television, and the Internet. This program has been held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Asia-Pacific Affairs member-led forum, also with the Japan Society of Northern California, Thai Silicon Valley, and the Keizai Society. I'm Ruth Shapiro, and now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.